are here today to recover memory and take action to recover our world. You know, people often say we live in dangerous times, and as the old saying goes, where others see danger, I see opportunity. And desperate times evoke a lot of good things in people, and all we have to do is look at our own life example to the lessons that are taught to us by desperate times. I remember when I was 7 years old, just a little anecdote here, when I was 7 years old, my swimming instructor down at Sherbrooke Swimming Pool in North Winnipeg, he took me down to the deep end to teach me how to swim, and I just expected him to get in the water with me and swim around. In fact, what he did is he shoved me into the deep end. And then not only that, he kept pushing me away from the side of the pool with a long pole. Well, you know, when you're 7 years old, that can kind of freak you out. And so after my initial cries of panic and unanswered cries for help, a deeper instinct took over inside me, and all of a sudden I found myself swimming. Well, that impulse switched on without any effort by me. It was automatic. It was caused by a desperate situation. It was evoked by it. And when I remember that, I remember the saying of Sun Tzu in The Art of War when he says, when you're in a desperate situation, use it to your advantage, because it brings out a resolve and a courage in the people around you that they wouldn't have in normal times. And I think we're seeing that. Well, I know we're seeing that all over the world. And it's especially embodied in our new Republic Alliance, which is now based in 10 countries in Australia, Europe, and North America, here on Turtle Island. And its objective is to set up a common law republic alternative to the growing corporate police state, the corporatocracy. And that hand of fate, like that swimming instructor kept pushing me away from the kind of safety that wouldn't have taught me anything, that is working now in all of our lives. In a way, we've all been exiled from our old existence, not just by circumstance and by our adversaries, but by the fact that in the course of this long struggle, we have become profoundly different people. We're different than we were before, and we have to seek out the company of others who have also made that shift, who are struggling for that new world. And that's exactly what we're doing for many years on the show and in our movement in Kanata. But now around the world, we're uniting common law republic patriots to take back our world, to overcome, try and prosecute and end the crimes against humanity, against children, the crimes of genocide. And today on the show, I'm going to be joined in an interview I did with a fellow Republic Alliance member, Owen Lucas from Ireland. And we're going to be talking about the contents of my book, Truth Teller's Shield, A Manual for Whistleblowers and Hellraisers, because there are many practical lessons in there that are a good example of what we need to do in these desperate situations. We've talked about our plans to organize workshops, tutorials, training sessions for how to reclaim the land, how to reclaim these properties from criminal organizations and churches. The training on the ground comes from the knowledge first, from our own life, but also embodied in this book, A Manual for Whistleblowers and Hellraisers, Truth Teller's Shield. So Owen and I will be talking about that, the origin of our work and our movement, the International Common Law Court of Justice, and the present cases being brought before it. You can follow all of this work, murderbydecree.com, republicofkanata.org, and write to us, Republic National Council, at protonmail.com. So that will be the show today. Enjoy it. Take notes. We'll be back again live next week. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. I thank you.
I mean, this is such a guidebook for you know, the global population at the moment. What's going on now? So much of this, it almost feels prophetic to read that you wrote this in 2016 and how relevant this is to now. And you talked about evil corporations just then. Here's one of my yellow quotes. Evil is real, specific, and has an address. People and institutions of the lie. A Russian saying goes that everyone reacts differently to a tickle, but always the same to a hot burning iron. Evil is like that. We all may have our own different idea of what evil is in the abstract, but when face to face with it, we all know evil for exactly what it is, an intentional, hideous, undeterred force of corruption and destruction. And so, like you're alluding to here, people project their own morals and ethics naturally onto other people and, you know, perhaps even corporations and this sort of thing. And that's a real big cold shower, I think, that, you know, people in arriving into the situation now have to get a grips with, is that this is something, you know, inverted to what humanity is in its purest form, right?
Well, the ancient Greeks had that famous quote, know thyself. That's the source of all wisdom. And Sun Tzu says, whoever knows their enemy and knows themselves will win every battle. And it's that, you know, we begin from that place of, do we really know who we are, what we're in, and what we're up against? And, you know, our pride and our desperation at sometimes because of what we're in compels us to think, well, we do know, but the reality is we don't really know until you've engaged actively with it. And I think that's one of the limitations of people now who are engaged in a lot of stuff. They haven't had the practical contact. They've got a sense of the reality either through the internet or hearsay or somebody else, but you really don't know the nature of something unless you're stomped by it. You know, the best teacher is a black eye, as they say, right?
Right. Yeah. And what seems to be one of their big tactics is very subtle, but very, very powerful isolation psychologically, right? And we're seeing this with this lock up or lockdown or house arrest, whatever you want to say it at the moment. And that drains the will and the enthusiasm to carry on. And this book, when I got hold of it, it was such a pep up. You know, I almost said shot in the arm, but it's probably not a good phrase for these times, but it really, really lifted my spirits, right? Because all of a sudden, you know, I've been in this, you know, trench for 2 years, and I found this book or this person, you, who totally understood where I was and what I was going through and what was happening, and that sense of I don't know, empathy or comradeship, perhaps even with a book, you know, through your book was such a you know, a lifeline, I think is a fair enough expression.
Well, I wrote it for exactly folks like you, who are, I mean, we're our best teachers, and we know this, we know our experience never lies to us, but we often don't have the confidence to draw the conclusions from what we've been through, you know, and come to our own understanding. So it's just really kind of what this has done is simply acknowledged to you what you already knew from something you'd been through. And you know, that's the most powerful kind of message, right?
But you kind of don't believe it, you know. You sort of slap me in the cheek. Is this actually real? Are these corporations that present themselves so, you know, with bells and whistles and polish or whatever you want to say, the TV stations, you know, are they all really that corrupt and evil and bad? And then all of a sudden, you know, an evidence of a seasoned campaigner like yourself puts this together. You read it and you absorb it and you think, wow, all those intuitive reactions that I was getting, you know, weren't to be dismissed at all. They were to, you know, that is the highest form of intelligence, right? Is intuition. But so many of us want to dismiss it, and we want to project, like I said, your own energies onto others and other bodies.
Well, yeah, and it's really important for people like you and me and others who have been targeted to get together, have our own support network, because the knowledge we have is a great weapon. It's the one thing the opposition doesn't want, for us to share what we've been through with others, our knowledge of this system, right? And that's why I laid out the book kind of like in steps almost, right? Like the actual attack on you, how you engage with your adversary, how you learn about them, how you survive, and how in the long run you're actually transformed, and your pain and suffering in turns out to be a doorway to something bigger, which is your own transformation, so that you can be a model for others in this long fight. So I found for myself, my original idea of what I wanted, you know, this notion of justice and the return of my job and my family, it was gone forever. But right. I couldn't accept that fact. But that pain allowed me to transform and go to a higher level where I could start looking at these other issues, right? You know, the genocide in Canada, but then, you know, the child trafficking and sacrificial killings by the Vatican and all these other crimes really connected to the COVID police state today. So I got transformed, but we got to be open to that transformation. We've got to see that our pain is a doorway to a higher purpose, really our purpose, why we're put here, you know, often.
There's a phrase, your greatest gifts come wrapped up as your worst nightmares. And yeah. I think that, you know, through this process, I've been at six, you know, not as many years as yourself, but it's almost an irony that your self-worth rises through your resilience that you found. And yet at the same time, you're feeling this kind of isolation process going on. And you know, your public self-worth, if you like, your profile publicly is being, you know, systematically undermined and deliberately so if your examples are to be taken valid, and of course they are.
Well, yeah, and I remember before this all happened, my greatest joy was, you know, to be with my kids and do my work as a minister in that. And then after a few years of losing all that, I found that I had an even higher joy by sitting with a group of people who had been through these crimes and just realizing that I was helping them take the next step. And we were saying no to this murderous machine and these people who had done this to them. That gave a satisfaction that no human love, that no worldly accomplishment could ever come close to, because we were, you know, as one of the native survivors said to me once, I used to be a victim, now I'm a threat.
Right.
And she said it with such joy. She was a 75-year-old woman, crushed her whole life, severe alcoholic because of the torture she'd been through at a very young age. And now there was a light in her eyes. She said, I know how to fight these bastards and win. I'm not afraid of them anymore. So now I'm a threat. And, you know, there was such triumph in her voice when she said that. And I thought, you know, this makes all the suffering worth it, just to have one person who you can help get to that point, right?
She finds that individual autonomous power at a time when you'd never expect to, right?
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, something really right at, soon after that, we had that talk in the healing circle in the downtown part of Vancouver. About a week later, one of the native guys on the street was grabbed by the police and beaten up severely and thrown in the in a cell. Maggie, who's the name of this native woman, I saw her personally at around midnight. She was standing on Main Street right outside the Vancouver police station. She was dragging a police barrier across the road to block the traffic to have a protest to demand that Trevor be released. And she was facing these 20 riot cops all by herself, just yelling at them, you know, you let Trevor go. She had no fear. And he was a woman who had been crushed in every way imaginable. She was this broken, kind of stereotypical drunk Indian, right? And there she is out on the street without an ounce of fear, because she had lost any fear. You know, that fear of death and loss that controls so many of us. Once you lose that, you're unbeatable. All they can do is kill her, but that doesn't stop her, right? I mean, that spirit enters into the whole big soup and inspires others, right? And I just remember that image of her out and facing the riot cops, thinking, you know, this is called a victory, right?
And how were the cops? They were totally dumbfounded that someone...
They did. They didn't know what to do. As a right. matter of fact, I went over and talked to them, and I said, you know, you guys had better back off, because there's a lot more people like her out there. Right? And sure enough, a couple hours later, they let Trevor free, because there is a whole bunch of us out there, and we wouldn't budge. We're sitting down on the street till they let him out. And I think that's an example for today, a lesson for today, how you get results. You know, you just put it right in their face. You show them you're not afraid. We see through their lies, and we're not backing down.
You know? Right. And there's an example in this book as well about the auto parts factory, and they have a sit-in, right? That's audacious surprise, I think, is a fair enough word, right? It's a surprise attack in against the enemy, right?
Right.
And they sat in the building, and the corporate heads and the, you know, the money classes, they had absolutely no idea about what to do about this you know, flag in the turf, right?
That was in the 1930s in America, in some of the big auto plants, when there was a big unionizing drive, and nobody had ever done that before. You know, the whole sit-ins in the 60s student protests, they borrowed it from that tactic. These auto workers just on their own realized, hey, look, what's the point of striking outside the factory? Let's sit in here and grab the boss's property, and then he'll have to come to the negotiating table. And sure enough, they buckled within a week of the sit-ins starting, right? The factory occupations. And those tactics are used all over the world spontaneously by people, because it's the basic thing, strike at what the enemy loves. Strike at their heart, which is money and public image.
Right.
And we found that with the churches, they buckled in the same way. When we started occupying churches on Sunday morning back in 2007 and 2008, the apology happened soon after that. They realized we know the churches went to the government of Canada and said, you better do something quick, because our property is at stake here. So, you know, that's one of the tactics we talk about in the book.
And there seems to be a reaction that they back away quickly. They're very brittle with their power. And that once that's, you know, that one lone woman, right? You know, Gandhi springs to mind as well. The salt mine marches, this kind of thing. Right. These individuals who show no fear and you know, get on the front foot and stand in the faces of them, it has an energetic power, right? We're talking spiritual force, right?
Moral force is unbeatable, but you just can't stop. And that's the thing. People get tired, which is understandable. But it's like, remember my grandfather's stories from World War One. In his Canadian regiment, there were three lines. There was the front line, the support line of the people who are going to come to relieve them, and then the rear guard, where you'd go for recovery, rest, and relaxation, right? And they would rotate all the time. So you couldn't keep people on the front line for very long, or they'd get wiped out. So we have to have a movement big enough that can do that. You know, you have frontline people, but then you learn, you go back, you do a seminar, you teach people stuff. You don't have to be on the front line all the time. That's how new people learn. By it. So in other words, it's a collective effort. It isn't just one expert doing this stuff, right?
Yeah. And talking about the front line, you know, what sprung to mind then was the tornado in Rome, right, in the Vatican. So you guys, I'd really love to you know, hear your version of this. But as a summary, you went to the Vatican to exercise energetics and dark, shadowy energetics that place has gathered over, you know, hundreds of years. And the response was from the planet, from the cosmos, tornadoes in the city of Rome that have never been recorded in terms of metrology, right?
The next morning, yeah. October 11, 2009, I had been invited. Well, at that point, I had been shut out of Canada after they brought in the official spin on the residential schools and the apology and all that. My name got swabbed out of the press. We were really marginalized after that because everything we had produced, all the evidence at murderbydecree.com, right, everything you could see in there, that was conflicting with the official spin, which said, oh, no, there were just a few children harmed and it wasn't deliberate genocide, right? So they had to kind of remove us from the public memory. But right at that same time, I got invited over by a bunch of folks in Ireland to start a similar campaign in Europe. And that culminated in when we formed that tribunal that put Ratzinger and the others on trial, and the Queen and others. But before that, I had gone to Rome to give some talks in that. And it didn't start out as an exorcism. I actually went there to do a memorial service in St. Peter's Square for all the victims of the Catholic Church. And I brought some soil from one of the mass graves of children at a Catholic Indian school in Ontario. And I was going to do a simple ceremony. And then I'm standing there and I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. We're in front of the beast here, you know.
All right.
I can't pass this opportunity up. So I thought, okay, well, let's call out that, you know, that spirit. And I actually had taken part in an exorcism once in Porto Berni. I know these forces are real, and I felt it there in a big way. So I thought, okay, let's put it right back in their face. And what was really interesting, Owen, is you're not allowed to stand in St. Peter's Square and do any kind of ceremony, political protest. The Rome police and the Vatican cops show up and arrest you. They had just done that to a group of Native women the previous month who had tried it, right? So there I am standing in St. Peter's Square with my regalia, with the soil from the grave of these children who'd been murdered by this church. And I just called him out. In the first stage of an exorcism, you call on the entity to name itself, expose itself, and thereby lose its power. And I did this untouched. These cops are walking by me like I'm invisible. Like, I don't know. I can't explain that. But I was untouched the whole time. I wasn't even challenged by anybody. The next morning at about 8 a.m., a tornado hits the center of Rome.
Right.
The first one in about 40 years. You can look it up in Il Manifesto. I've got it reproduced, you know, the article showing all these chairs and everything blown all over the place. Yeah. It just struck out of nowhere. And that same week, what was even more interesting, that same week, the European media started reporting how the Pope Benedict at the time was covering up child crimes against children, not just, you know, rape, but trafficking and even murder. And so, sure enough, that whole thing opened up and it's never been closed since, right? So we are connected with a power we don't even understand. It's greater than ourselves. But I was thinking all of the people over the centuries have been harmed by that church. Yeah, they were acting through what we do. And you know, I believe very much that happens too. There's a whole spiritual element of this that we can't ignore, right?
Yeah, and it must have been, again, a real enthusiasm boost to feel that there was an ally that you had that was, you know, from the galaxy, from the ether, right? And that, you know, what you're doing is far more than, you know, Newtonian building blocks going about his business, that you're on a mission, you know, from a much higher or vast perspective.
I believe that's true. Yeah, I've learned that in practice. You know, I didn't set out with that idea at all. I just thought this was one thing, and it's evolved into something much bigger, right?
Right, completely. And so that was before or after the 2013? No, that was 2010, right? You just said
2009. There was
2009.
3 years before we started the actual court case that convicted.
Okay. How did that, you know, I think it's really relevant for people to hear how you know, was it, how did the first email go to get that 2013 court case where you're finding two popes, a queen, prime ministers, and these top bigwigs of, you know, corporations or whatever. What's the spark? What's the initiatory moment that gets all that momentum going towards that?
Well, it was a whole process, and it had started in Canada in 1995. It was like a tsunami building. We're building on all the evidence, all the work we'd done. People in Ireland and Europe had heard about me. They invited me over. You know, I remember sitting the first time I was in a group of people in Dublin when we were forming the tribunal. They were telling me the same kind of stories I'd heard all over the Aboriginal world in Canada. Same crime, same cover-up, the same church doing it. The medical experimentation using children and drug testing that killed them, Pfizer that are pushing the COVID shots now, using children experimentally. You know, I often say to people, why the hell would you take a needle from a murderous drug corporation and their compliant governments, right?
Johnson & Johnson, similarly, there was a group of mothers that got together and found that the Johnson & Johnson products were carcinogenic, and you know, they had a huge litigation bill, I think, for that. And then, similarly, you know, they're another one.
Well, Merck, Pfizer, Eli Lilly, they're all complicit. Bayer, they go back to the Nazi era. These are genocidal corporations, and that's a whole other issue. But I'm sitting there listening to all the Irish talking about this, and I said, look, you know, we're facing the oldest corporation on the planet. Spans borders. We've got to be united across borders to do that, and that's where the idea of the tribunal came about. But again, it's like from the you know, truth teller's shield here. The basic question you always have is, where is your enemy weak? You never attack them where they're strong, but where are they weak? And again, it's the public image. So we started hitting Catholic churches in downtown Dublin, and we got tons of media coverage. The Irish Independent, you know, it was a popular topic. And our advantage was we had a lot of evidence. We had a lot of eyewitnesses coming forward. So there'd been a lot of preamble, which made it easier for us. It's a lot harder these days if you start cold on an issue with a lot of evidence and witnesses. You got to spend your whole time trying to convince the world. And that's not our job, to convince people. Our job is to attack an enemy where they're weakest and bring out the truth. Because like you say, these corporations, that's just a fiction. It's just a facade. Behind it are human beings who can be reached, and they don't want to lose their legal coverage, their insurance coverage. They don't want to be legally liable for anything. And when you do threaten that, then they start buckling. It happens quicker than people realize, you know, who are standing on the sidelines of the struggle, right?
Yeah. And you see it very clearly as an adversary, an enemy, and it's, you know, perhaps not a conventional war, but it is a warfare situation that's been running for decades, centuries, perhaps millennia, right?
And it's a war, and you're
comfortable with that, right? Because I hear a lot of dialogue at the moment. You know, the word war, civil war, is being touted around here, there, and ever, and a lot of people are uncomfortable with it because they feel like it's a nudge in that direction. To
all right, like we're feeding the violence by even using the language,
right? I share your comfort with that, because if you're being, you know, baseball batted to the floor, then you're in a combat situation, right? And how you deal with that is a practicality.
Well, I mean, they've killed my friends. They've killed people I know out and out murder. William Coombs, who saw Queen Elizabeth take those children, murder, you know, arsenic poison. In St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver. I mean, and they've done everything possible of physically killing me. So it's like when you're in a war and you're under fire, you can't deny it's suicidal to deny what's happening to you. Right. So I'm going from an experience, not, let's go get the bastards. It's more like, how are we going to defend ourselves in the face of this? And they have no qualms. The people who we are facing on this stuff have no qualms about killing other people. They get other people to do it for them, but they have no worry about that. So it's not so much entering into violence, but recognizing that if you stand back, you are engaged in another form of violence, the violence of the system. By not challenging it, you're aiding and abetting that violence. So it's really a question of how do we do this with the least damage possible? You do that by, as I did with this whole movement, striking at where they're vulnerable. And ultimately, they're just people, and they even their conscience. You see, I find with people in these leadership positions, their conscience has been atrophied at a very young age. People like to talk to them about them as if they're lizards or they're, you know, dehumanized, soulless clones or something. No, that's not true at all. They're human beings, because people are capable of almost anything in the right circumstances, right? We know that from the death camps in Europe. We know that from the residential schools. These people who did the crimes were ordinary men and women. I remember that there was this famous talk, Robert Jackson. He was one of the American prosecutors at Nuremberg. And he gave a talk after World War II to a Jewish congregation in Manhattan. And he said to them, the SS were no different than you and I. Right. And it just scandalized. Everyone was up in arms and outraged when he said that. But he said, no, when you look at it, it was only a very small minority who were actual psychopaths. Everybody else was ordinary people put in a corporate structure where you can defer moral responsibility to somebody else. So the guy said, oh, I just drove the train, unloaded them. I didn't kill them. Well, I pulled the trigger, but there was a blank in one of the guns, which they always do on firing squads. So giving people, individuals, a feeling that, well, maybe I didn't kill them, to allow them a moral way out of an amoral situation, right? So we're dealing with men and women that can be reached. This is a struggle for hearts and minds. And as we saw, like, all of this stuff wouldn't be happening now with all of, like, America now has announced they're going to do an investigation into the Indian schools, and they're using the same rhetoric, the same cover-up as in Canada. But I'm thinking, that's happened because of the example of a very few of us. We caused that whole earthquake that's happening now, right? And the same thing can happen in this whole battle against the COVID police state, because they're shaking. I mean, they're using very desperate measures, as we've talked about before. It shows that their backs are to the wall, I think.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. There was just this afternoon, I was listening to a woman over here, Rachel Elner. She was looking at the triangle of persecutor, victim, and rescuer. And she was saying that there's a fight and flight aspect. And so when people are children, if they haven't got either option to fight or flight, then this a sort of buffer zone of numbness, emotional numbness builds up.
Right.
And then that provides a space or a capacity for psychopathy to arrive. That's quite a broad way to say it. But in comes this perhaps phantom self is an interesting way to look at it. And that maneuverability, that mind control is much easier to facilitate if a child has been brought up in an awful traumatized and difficult. The boarding school environment is very much like a concentration camp environment, seems to me. And there seems to be a prevalence and a preference to get as much concentration camp environment, you know, whether that's schools or whether that's prisons or, you know, whatever it is. And that perhaps, again, facilitates and assists the modern population stuff, right?
Well, you know, the whole British aristocracy, they went through these. I remember, you know, Churchill describing the way he was flogged as a little boy at Eton or Harrow or whatever it was. I went to a private boys' school for 4 years when I was in elementary school in Winnipeg. It was fashioned on the British model of, you know, we had our hair grabbed, we were beaten by the teacher. In the 1960s, corporal punishment was still legal and encouraged in Canada, just like in England. So when you're brutalized at a young age, you lose empathy. You lose empathy for yourself, and so you can't really have it for anybody else. And you're this numb, you know, that classic film of Bill Gates sitting giving testimony in front of Congress. And he's sitting there with his arms around himself, rocking back and forth, right?
Right.
Like, you know, self-medicated position of an abused child. Well, what the hell happened to him? It's irrelevant, because what he's serving now, it's a corporate system that requires that kind of individual. So the problem is the system. It isn't, you know, like...
Well, they're farming psychopaths on there.
They are, yeah. And you've got to be psychopathic to function and dissociated to operate in the society, right? And when you're not dissociated, you're a disruption in their system. And we talk about that in this book, too. Like, all you have to do is stand on your own conscience and never stop. And you cause the whole machine to come to a sputtering stop. And the longer one person does that, the more the machine comes to a stop. That's the power one man or woman have. But we're taught to think, well, you can't do anything unless you have thousands of people. Well, it only took a couple of dozen of us to force the genocide onto the Canadian agenda, because we just never gave up, and we had all the solid evidence, right?
And you lacked fear. That's a crucial factor, right? And they could feel that.
We had fear individually, but together we lost it, and that's how it works. You know, the classic example I give about William Coombs, who couldn't even go near a Catholic church because it would make him physically ill. He heard a church bell because he used to torture him on a rack, Catholic priests, and sodomize him with an electric cattle prod. I mean, so he couldn't go near a church. But the day we occupied Holy Rosary Church March 2008, he was there inside with us. And I thought, how the hell did you do that? He couldn't have done it on his own. But he said to me, I didn't want to let everybody down. I wanted to be there for all of you, right? And that was the best healing he ever had. And he didn't drink. He gave up drinking for a while after that, because it gave him such a sense that I'm not afraid of these people. I'm not afraid of these priests anymore. But he got that from all of us doing it together. So there's just so much you can do as an individual. The integrity starts here, but it manifests in all of us doing it, or not even all of us, but a conscious, determined minority. They're the ones who can move mountains. And we've proven that, right?
Someone coming into this zone now, as I think, you know, multitudes will be, it's very deflating to see that enormity of the corporate world and the, you know, the police and the agencies of the state, etc. and that I feel is one of the weapons that they count on most, is that the enormity of what they're up against and the illusion of that too. And yet you're saying that just saying no, just holding firm in who you are and with your autonomy and your sovereignty is enough to put a real dent in their operations and to give you enough self-worth and self-belief to, you know, take it day by day.
I think there's some of us can do that better than others. It's just a question of character. It's different. But with everybody, here's the case. I remember there was a famous battle in the American Civil War where there was a bunch of Confederates. And they outnumbered the Union forces attacking them, but they're up on this mountain. And the Union soldiers were stretched up in a very long line, and all the Union soldiers could see their strength. They just looked to left and right, they could see it. But the Confederate soldiers were in these little nooks and crannies, and they couldn't see their strength. All they could see were thousands of guys coming at them. And even though they outnumbered the Union forces, and they were better armed and in better strategic position, they broke and ran. Because it was a simple question of morale. They could see all of the enemy's strength, and they couldn't see any of their own. And similarly, the Union forces realize they're up against these guys, but look at all of our strength. And I always remember that now, because that's the way it is on the internet. All we can see sitting there by yourself is all of the strength of the enemy. It's done. 99% of what you see is contrived, because it's designed to create fear. They don't have that power. They don't have a lot of people masking or taking the shot. We don't know how many people are, but they're telling all the time how strong they are, how invincible they are, how there's no alternative but to go along. That's creating a frightened slave population. So we literally have to turn our mind off of that and look around and just know from our own life, look at our strength. Look at what we've endured as human beings over thousands of years. That's our strength, right? And look at the example of a few of us who have forced change. That's why they keep censoring out all the news of what we've done, because so the people can't take strength and courage from that, right?
Sapping the enthusiasm. It's a bluff brinkmanship, right?
Right. It's all psychological warfare.
It's all bluff and hot air in order to sink psychologically the opponent. And as Sun Tzu says, out of war, you once that belief and enthusiasm and hearts and minds have gone, then the battle's over. On page 110, we got the question I sent you. In what context should today's truth tellers interpret Vietnam veteran Daryl Adams' words in 1981? The problem for me isn't surviving. The problem is how to relate to the rest of humanity now that my eyes are open. So here we have a sort of split societally. It's really evident over here where, you know, they're helping it along as much as they can with the vaxxers versus the anti-vaxxers, or, you know, the splingers wherever possible. But that that relationship of the truth teller and the person standing firm, their whole social world is going to blow apart, right? It's going to completely metamorphosize.
Right, and that's the first stage. And the only way to go through that is to realize that you don't have to relate to the rest of humanity. Because don't forget, that's an abstraction. It's like saying the state or the church, or those are abstractions. They don't exist. What exists is our experience of the men and women around us. And those are the ones we relate to. And in fact, when you start talking to people, you find that the differences are a lot less than we imagine, right? Even with people who are in favor of the shot or against the shot, that's a false narrative that's been created that we're all supposed to mimic, right?
Divide and rule, classic.
Absolutely. So we just ignore that whole agenda, and we understand the methods they use against us. Like, you know, the old saying, power isn't what you have necessarily, it's what your enemy thinks you have. So, you know, if there's enough people who are simply saying no, they already have backed off when that's happened. You know, when police have stood outside legislatures in Canada, which they did recently, and said, we're not taking the shot, suddenly you see them backing off a bit. Because, you know, in terms of the regulations they're bringing in and everything. So, I mean, it's all that battle for, you know, our own mind, really, comes down to, right?
The phrase psychopath as well has a lot of charge to it, right? The movies show a psychopath to be, you know, an axe-wielding killer, cold-blooded murderer, this kind of thing. And again, I feel that that's very much what you might call a predictive programming or whatever to increase that fear and lack of self-belief again. Another quote here. Every powerful institution on a planet is led and run by functional psychopaths who must subordinate every human feeling and restraint to the dual corporate goals of efficiency and self-preservation. There are no exceptions, from governments to private companies to churches and the military. Once you run afoul of such a system, and you show that you can't or won't cooperate with its inhuman requirements, then how that machine seeks either your compliance or your destruction will follow a predictable pattern and method. In the darkness that is descending or will descend on you, your own experience, your inner stamina, and your unsullied common sense are your best guides and weapons, now and in the times to come. In the new conditions that are your life, there is no one for you to trust except yourself. And whatever greater power you believe in, regardless of your faith or lack of it, you must become your own gospel and compass.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, again, we all learn that when you go through that. And, you know, right after that, I talk about the three Ds, distraction, discrediting, and destruction, right? Which is the methods they use to counter what we're doing. And any of us who take a stand, we face this, right? They distract by getting people not to look at what you're talking about. They try to discredit you through the usual smear campaigns. And usually they'll get people to come forward to pretend that they know you and say, oh, yeah, I can see through him. He's a fraud, blah, blah, blah. You can see that shit about me all over the internet still.
Yeah.
And the final stage, if none of that works, is they just destroy you. But they don't want to kill you. That's a last resort, which makes you a martyr. They want to get people so afraid of you that they don't want that no one will listen to you. Or, you know, and that's what they've tried, you know, with me. But again, it doesn't, like I often say to people, a smear campaign helps you in the long run because it's meant to take you out quickly. And if it doesn't, it just brings more attention to you. Right. And people say, oh, that guy's still around, really, after this long. Well, I wonder why. Like, maybe he's got something to say, right?
Peaks and troughs, right? Could you plot a graph with your peaks and troughs on along those lines?
Oh, very much, yeah. I find the attacks come when I start getting more exposure in different place, when it starts having an impact. And then the main way they do it is they come in with their substitute, like their version of the story. That's what corporate damage control and PR is all about.
So in a way, you can gauge your success or how well you're doing by the amount of grief, the intensity of the attacks coming at you, particularly smear campaigns, right?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, they only use smear campaigns to one degree. That isn't their chief weapon. That's to get people to drop away so you don't have support. And, you know, again, like trying to isolate you, the main weapon is they create their substitute reality for people to believe. So, for example, in Canada, They talked about, oh, yeah, okay, they're mass graves now. They finally, after 20 years of us talking about it, they say, yeah, they're mass graves. But there's only 215 children, and we don't really know how they died, and that's all we could find. So now, everywhere in Canada you go, when the topic of residential schools come up, you don't hear 60,000 children, which is what we proved. You see that number 215. So they got to burn that number in people's head, and they go, oh, well, a couple of hundred children, that's unfortunate, but it's not genocide, is it? Okay. So it, again, they you can't, it's from a member reading excerpts from a CIA manual during the Vietnam War. It said, you cannot stop a revolution, but you can guide it. You can guide the flow of that river. And that's what they always try to do. They take an issue and energy and guide it along the chain of the path that they can control. And they normalize the crime, they minimize it, and then hope people go back to sleep. Right?
Control the narrative, right? I really feel like Donald Trump is very much in that kind of guise. You know, you look at a couple of characters in history, and perhaps the guy from the French Revolution, his name escapes me, but it'll come to me. They're putting in their patsy characters, right? Their stooges to play the Pied Piper's flute and pull all the people of this ilk and this kin along with them, and they're controlling the narrative. Even if there's a great book by a guy called David McGowan, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, which is a play on the Jim Morrison and the Doors quote lyric, Weird Scenes Inside the Gold Mine. But the canyon is Laurel Canyon outside Los Angeles, His point of the book basically is they set up the hippie movement in the 60s, especially to control the anti-war sentiment. Right?
Well, like the CIA introducing LSD into the movement, the LSD was developed in CIA labs in the 50s, and it just strung everybody out, right? And made them very inward and you know, self-absorbed, and everything that the movement had been building up, they try to disintegrate, but that only works if people go along with it. And again, it's a question of character and stamina, very much.
It seems to me that they've cried wolf too much. There's been so much frequency of you know, Black Lives Matter and whatever they're trying to pull this time. It's almost obvious the moment it starts what's going on with it. And a couple of little digs around at the leaders of these sort of things, and you see we follow the money. If there's a scandal, follow the money, right? And they just seem to be getting busted far more quickly than perhaps they would have in the 60s, and they're busted flush. Perhaps they're running out of ideas, right?
Yeah, well, time is on our side. That's the reality. We have time and numbers on our side, and again, it's just turning away from their reality onto ours, right?
Being a soulless machine, the thing, capital T, you face lives according to the lies, appearances, and measures required to preserve its own power and nothing more. This makes someone like you, this truth teller, quite incomprehensible to it. Just as how it operates makes no sense to you as a moral being. Ask for justice or decency from it, and you will face a dead wall of indifference, hollow rhetoric, or meaningless gestures. But threaten its operations and income, and it will suddenly notice you, and it will be forced to respond to you. And again, that's taking the narrative back from them, right? So that they have to respond to, it's the front foot, my phrase at the moment.
Oh, well, you know, Sun Tzu's classic example that it doesn't matter how small you are. If you define the terms of battle, you'll win. Whoever defines the terrain, he calls it forming the ground. You define an issue, you define the narrative, and you stick to it, and they have to come around to you. We did that. We said it's genocide, it's not child abuse, and now everyone's using the word genocide. Right. It's just a matter of, you know, kind of physics. You can just enforce relative force. And one of the parts in the book I want to point out, too, is called, on page 41, Learning the Sniper's Trade, the Advantage of Being Small, Mobile, and Unpredictable.
Because and so from that principle, is it better to stay small? You know, if these assemblies get too big and unwieldy, that's a disadvantage, perhaps.
That's what we found. Every one of our big assemblies was taken out. We operate in cell groups now with three people, go around, and you can strike out of nowhere and disappear, and they don't know what you're going to do next. That's classic guerrilla warfare. You live off the strength of the enemy. You define the terms of battle. They have to guard against you at every point. They can only act in certain ways because they're an unwieldy big corporation. They have protocols and policies to follow and vested interests. We don't have any of that. Uh-huh. And so what you never do what the enemy expects you to do or you're lost. So you don't go out and hold a protest. They're expecting that. You don't write a petition. That's all containable, right? Right. You do something totally new and original. And I remember there's a guy, Saul Alinsky, wrote a book called Rules for Radicals. He was a community organizer in Chicago. And in the 60s, he was trying to integrate one of the airports. And they said, okay, let's not pick at the place. Let's have a shit-in. A shit-in was they went and occupied all the toilets in the airport. And within an hour, the whole place was shut down because all these people were running to catch flights. And they couldn't get into the bathroom. All the bathrooms were locked and people were sitting in the toilets not coming out. And the airport buckled immediately. He gave in immediately and desegregated, I think it was Landers, Atlanta, Georgia or something. But the point is that you got to do what hurts them and which they don't expect. And once you've done that, it doesn't matter how small you are. One person doing that has an amazing impact way beyond their numbers.
Is it your books? There's a passage I remember from somewhere where leadership is an interesting one too. They have these very rigid and brittle structures of leadership and chain of command, and yet we have no leadership. We're all autonomous and sovereign, and so they can't disrupt and interrupt any leadership. They can't take out leaders, right? Because there aren't, and we're all working from our own engines, right?
Exactly. That's why you've got to generalize the knowledge all the time. You don't have a few experts. And if you have experts, they've got to pool their knowledge so everybody knows it. It's like I used to do in my church. I would sit down and give somebody else a turn to get up at the pulpit, right? I'd open the pulpit to anybody, right? It's the same idea. Also, in a police state, which is what we're in, global police state, you have to operate in that way because you've got to have cells all over the place. Otherwise, you lop off the leaders and everything falls apart. And you can't have the kind of hierarchical structure. It's a kiss of death. You need decentralized cell group operation.
And that's very much a sign of their weakening, I think, is that, a main characteristic of psychopathy, lack of empathy, vindictive exploitation, but also... not deception. Where you can't be your cover. You can't be seen. There's the words escaping me. But so that they're hiding, right? And so what's happening now is that it's the sea monsters coming up to the surface. The elephants coming into the room. Whatever expression you want to use. And so the world can see much more clearly what was far less evident back in the day, right?
Absolutely. And, I can't figure out strategically why the system is doing this. They're killing themselves because they're attacking everybody now. You never attack everybody. The strength of an elite lies in dividing and conquering. In attacking one group and pitting another group against another, they're not doing that. They've got the scattergun approach where everybody has to do it. Everybody has to get the shot. Those fairly conservative policemen would not have been protesting if they had been exempt, but they don't make them exempt. Everybody has to do it. So that to me is a sign that the people on top are increasingly unstable. You find that in history when empires fall apart, the people at the top make increasingly self-destructive decisions, almost like they want to fall apart. They want their empire to end because it's not rational what the political and corporate leaders are doing nowadays.
You mean they want to self-destruct at a deep sort of subconscious psychological level?
I believe so. I think that there's a death wish in any oppressive system on the part of the people.
At a soul level, they want to escape.
I think so. I think that that's at work, definitely. And now we can play on that. Like they divide and conquer us, we can divide and conquer them. And it happens really easily. You can do it. You just appeal to the human being behind the big mask. Right.
They do it themselves. Over here, the government is trying to install these rules to get children injected, and their main scientific advisors, the JCVI, the Joint Committee of Vaccine, blah blah blah. I can't remember the name, but basically these this, you know, the science has been backing the government all the way through, but now it's got to the children and they can feel, you know, the public fury about this potential. They've come out publicly and put their own fissure or crack in the dam, whatever you want to say, between themselves and the government, because they don't want to be associated with this corral of slurry pit, right?
You know, the instinctive desire parents to protect their children, that's something that's a powerful force in nature. Most of the people, both in the campaign about genocide and in our Republic movement in Canada, 80% of the people in meetings are women, and they're often mothers, you know, and they say the same thing all the time. I'm doing this for my children, for the next generation. That's a powerful force that they can't overcome, right? That's innate in us, right?
Yeah. Yeah. One more quote to finish, Kevin. We hit the hour again. Let's just go with this one. War of maneuver. Flowing from this guerrilla army stance is the recognition that most of our active engagement of our adversary does not consist of direct confrontation, but of a constant war of maneuver in order to find the key moment and place at which to strike. Okay, German word coming up here. Apologies if anybody's first language. The Schwerpunkt, or decisive point in any battle. The war of maneuver is best understood by recognizing that in the natural order, power is not found in solid phenomena, but in a constant energetic flow of relationships, which are always in constant flux. The power of a squirrel to cross a river on a log lies neither in the log or in the squirrel in themselves, but in their temporary combination. That brief union is their power. Every human interaction and social conflict is the same way, and the outcome is determined not by fixed methods, but by what momentary maneuver most effectively allows a sudden change in the power balance. A practical example of this lies in the tactic of the sit-in, and it's got an energy of its own. You know, rather than try and plan stuff, things are going to happen in the moment, right? Inspiration.
Well, the example of the sit-in was at the time when the auto workers created, and even during the 60s, it was creative. It struck in a way that they didn't expect, but then they co-opted it quickly. So now they have like sit-in rooms. They have protest areas, free speech zones in cities. They corral the dissent quickly. You know, they absorb it. So you can't stay stuck in one tactic or it's used against you. You have to be fluid all the time and think of new ideas and recognize that there's no final outcome in a war. There's just the latest event, and you can always build on that and use it to your advantage. So you got to think fluidly all the time, right?
Mm-hmm. And just to close, I couldn't find it. Maybe it is in this book, but co-intel-pro? I just remember that phrase from a while back. These are intelligence personnel agents.
Yeah.
Who are looking to disrupt and undermine very powerful truth tellers, you know, such as yourself. Have you got personal interaction experience and evidence of them having gone through?
Oh, yeah. COINTELPRO was created by the FBI back in the 50s.
It's short for something, right? Counterintelligence
program. And it was aimed at the American Indian Movement and Black Panthers. It destroyed them from within. And that's a whole thing again about, you know, the methods they use to destroy groups. They go in and they attack the most effective organizers and start a rumor campaign about them. They get people to be so suspicious of each other that the group destroys itself from within. And that's happened to me 4 times now in 4 different campaigns I was involved in. And they use the same tactics every time. And it works every time because most people in the movement are new. They're kind of naive, and they don't realize that their fears are being targeted, that they're being manipulated psychologically. Right?
So their insecurities are actively being affected, manipulated, but they don't know it.
But again, it's all the state can do. They have a set thing they do, and the purpose of this book was to show people what their tactics are, so we can be educated and maneuver around it. Because if you say no to fear, no to misinformation, and I say to people, never believe a rumor about somebody, never pass on a rumor. Like, you know, the smears about me is, we hear this about Kevin. I say, okay, well, show me the evidence. Show me an eyewitness. And they never can because it's a rumor somebody started to get people gossiping. And that's a lot of what happens on the internet. It's gossip, stuff you hear from somebody else. But I say, go to the person. Don't let yourself be divided. don't ever have a personal conflict publicly. Work it out among yourselves. That's the methods they use to try to get people to fight each other. And it's so obvious what they do, and yet you've got to be a veteran and gone through it to see it, and you've got to persist to allow that knowledge to be shared with others, right?
Right. The longevity is the evidence in itself, right? And with That's the right. gossip thing, it's interesting. I just day before yesterday, was listening to a Dr. Andrew Kaufman, and he's saying exactly that the virus itself has not officially been isolated and identified. And so, you know, it in itself is a rumor, right? It's something that's been created that's smeared around.
And it's a commercially viable rumor, because I just saw a thing in the store the other day. It was a cleaning fluid, and it says, it gets rid of the COVID virus. And I thought, right. Well, shit, if all we're doing is we need a cleaner out of a can to get rid of the COVID virus, why have the shot, people? So people just use this stuff. They just make stuff up, and everyone just believes it because of the fear level, right?
Right, it completely is. Okay, let's wrap this up. Maybe make it a weekend regular thing.
I'd love to do this regularly, because in a way we've just scratched the surface. There's a lot more we can get into, and let's do more of this.
Yeah, I think that, you know, today's one. It's another bit at the start. You know, we're sort of going right back to the beginning, but there was a really interesting bit for you, and I was thinking to myself, wow, I wonder how many people are in this spot that you were in, you know, back in the 90s, as a young United Church of Canada clergyman and a, inverted commas, happily family man, I was blind to the corporate entity I was part of until it reached out and destroyed my life. But even when it attacked me, I continually denied what was happening to me because it was too fantastic and horrible to believe. Denial is a primary defense mechanism of the human mind and of entire communities. And I indulged in it unswervingly, even as my world was being destroyed. My greatest problem back then was that I refused to learn from my own experience. Mm-hmm. Mentally disarmed by my own denial, I was bushwhacked time and again and was nearly overwhelmed by those who wanted me dead and forgotten. The face and methods of war never change, only the circumstances and actors. And it's spookily relevant and accurate how what you're writing in this book applies so directly to people just beginning this you know, unveiling of what's really going on in the world, right?
Yes, and that's why I love holding workshops for people. Often we take like a Saturday for a few hours and take some of my books and relate this stuff to the actual issues and concerns people are involved in. And that's where I find that my best impact happens these days, just passing on the knowledge, acting like an elder and a mentor to others, but not telling them what to do, not giving them a blueprint, but encouraging them to, you know, think and act for themselves, and they'll learn their own truth about all of this.
Yeah. Smashing. Thanks, Eve, guys.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah.
Talk again.
Talk to you again.